Welcome to Hormone Health Podcast, brought to you by Georgia Hartman and Chloe Sheehan.
This podcast is an extension of Hormone Health Studio, which is our naturopathic clinic based here in Newcastle and online.
We're just two naturopaths who love a laugh, coffee, croissants, and conversations about real people with real health concerns.
Nothing's off limits. We're here to educate you on what's happening in your body, share emerging research, and debunk buried health misconceptions.
So sit back and let us do the talking. Chloe, today we're talking about golden poo. Is that what he said in the episode?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. If there was anything I took from that conversation, it was the resilient golden poo.
Yeah, that he's got. So today, in today's episode, we are interviewing Dr. Brad Leach, who, gosh, when you hear our intro with all of his credentials, he's phenomenal. He's just a wealth of knowledge. And we're talking all about the microbiome, specifically the gut microbiome.
And we're talking about how the gut microbiome influences hormonal health, how it influences mood, how it influences weight. It's really interesting hearing about the way that he talks about how passionate he is about the gut microbiome, talking about it almost like it's like a solar system with all these intricacies and how much it can be influenced by what we do day to day.
You'll understand when he talks about his golden poo what we're referring to, but essentially he has so many species in that gut of his.
The more species is better. That's what we're aiming for.
I need to do this gut test too. I don't know how many species
like,
I have.
Like, I'm not like spiritual or anything, but like in my head I'm seeing 76.
Oh, really? For me or for you? 76 seems bad.
Yeah.
Thanks, Chloe.
Considering I've only been eating potato, I don't know if my gut's going to be very diverse. It's like, you've got one species for McChicken.
Potato.
Potato and McChicken burgers.
Did you have a McChicken last
night?
No,
I didn't. I couldn't be bothered. And
couldn't be bothered to go through Macca's drive-thru.
So I had Weet-Bix.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, well, you know where to come to for all of your nutrition advice. We will learn today, actually, some really helpful nutritional tips.
Just as a little insight, something that I found super fascinating that that Brad was saying is that when we recommend gut testing for our clients, it can be an expense. You know, it's an extra expense. But he was explaining that one of the machines that basically interprets the gut microbiome results, it costs like $30,000 to just start it up.
Just to turn it on. And it's such a good perspective when we're talking about a gut test that can cost $300, $400, $500. You think, oh my goodness, that like seems so out of reach. Like, why is it so expensive? That's why.
And so, yeah, let's...
Yeah,
let's
this is listen. A good one. This is a good one.
You're going to learn today.
Dr. Brad Leach is a PhD qualified clinical nutritionist and herbalist specializing in chronic autoimmune conditions and complex gastrointestinal disorders. He provides complete and personalized care to his patients using functional nutrition, integrative medicine, and holistic wellness.
After entering the profession in 2008, which seems like a while ago, Brad has taught and developed subjects at leading universities and conducted research on intestinal permeability, autoimmunity, and food-based probiotics.
Brad is the lead clinical educator at CoBiome by Microba, where his expertise in gastrointestinal healthcare enables him to translate the latest science on the gut microbiome into practical clinical applications.
And in addition to being an adjunct fellow at the National Centre of Naturopathic Medicine, Brad offers practitioner support through his multiple mentoring programs, and we have Brad here today.
Georgia, Chloe, it's fantastic to be here chatting
all
about the microbiome.
Yes, we are so excited to pick your brain. Before we started recording this podcast, we said to Brad that we saw him speak at uni years, like, I don't know, I couldn't even give a year, but years and years and years ago about zonulin.
We're not age shaming.
A few years ago. Yesterday, as my son says, he calls everything that's happened in the past yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, I went to the park yesterday. It's like, no, you didn't. Anyway.
But this for you, Brad, is your area of specialty.
Mm.
You love the gut. And
I'm a bit of a gut nerd.
Gut nerd, yeah. And I think more and more people are realizing how important and influential their gut health is. So today we're going to pick your brain all about, you know, everything to do with the gut. But I have a question for you to start off with. What is the microbiome?
No, that's a great place to start because the microbiome is downright incredible. It is basically our second brain, our immune system, our detoxification system. It's basically essential to life. Without the microbiome, we die. And we've seen this in animal studies and even in some very ill patients. When their microbiome disappears, things, including themselves, will disappear as well. But on a more scientific level, the microbiome are all the bacteria and fungi and viruses and their genes that live on us and also within us. Now, one of the most densely populated areas is, of course, within our gut, and we call that the gut microbiome. Now, it's really interesting when you dive into the research around the microbiome. So many researchers have tried to quantify the exact number of bacteria that reside in the gut. And there's numbers that float around saying that there's as many as human cells in the body, or there's three times more than human cells in the body. But what I find more clinically relevant is how many species are found within an individual's microbiome. So on average, within, let's say, humans, there could be anywhere between 4,000 to 6,000 species within the gut. Now, if we take a typical healthy Australian, on average, they have 200 species. So of that 4,000 to 6,000 species that they could have in their gut, they generally have around 200 different species. Now, to put this into perspective a little bit, I sometimes like to think of myself as the practitioner with the golden poo. In the sense of my microbiome, I have 250 species of bacteria in my gut. And so it's a bit of a joke between myself and other gut nerds out there, Chantel Yates and Jason Hollowick and Narala Jacoby, other practitioners who are very fascinated with the microbiome. Who's got the most amount of species in my gut? So far, a practitioner called Narala Jacoby, the SIBO doctor, she has beaten me. I think she's got 270 species. But we can actually compare this to some of my most ill patients. Now, some of my most ill patients will have 100 or fewer species, right? Now, I recall one patient, and I will never forget this patient. He had inflammatory bowel disease, which is an autoimmune disease within the gut, and he'd been on multiple rounds of antibiotics, and we measured his microbiome. So we measured all of the species in his gut. He only had 20 species in his gut.
Oh, gosh.
20 species. Now, The vast majority of these were pretty nasty species. So that's on one end of the scale. And I mentioned, you know, having golden poo. We can look at the other end of the scale. And there's research that came out about June 2023 that looked at some of the most diverse microbiomes in the world over in sub-Saharan Africa, where all they do is just chew on roots and stems all day. They have upwards of 750 species in their gut. So it puts my 250 species to shame.
And yes, maybe you're insignificant.
the EMF I'm exposed to and other toxins in the environment are actually impacting my own microbiome. So diversity is so important when we look at the microbiome. And something gets thrown around quite a lot is we as researchers and educators and practitioners, we say the microbiome is linked with all of these health conditions. But how? So I just want to touch on that very briefly, that how. Now, there's two potential ways, broadly speaking, that the microbiome might impact health. The first is with species. So when I say species, there's a hierarchy of how we classify bacteria. It goes down from phylum and genus and species and then down to strain as well.
It's like eucalyptus, like you have this like different types of eucalyptus, and then you have different species and
that's the way I sort of remembered it when I was at uni, like trying to understand the gut in that sense.
Exactly. Or we could say dogs. We all love our furry friends.
Yeah.
We've got canines. That's, you know, the genus. Then we can go down into the species, and that's going to be more like your, I've got two Boar Doodles. So I've got Scotch and Soda. They're Border Collie cross Poodle, and they are just the funnest, cutest little dogs. Great for the microbiome as well.
I was going to say, also probably why you have Golden Poo.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a research study on those types of dogs for the gut.
So those species, on a species level, they can change inflammation. They can modulate our hormones. They can impact our immune system. They can have a individual action. But then these particular species can also produce what we refer to as metabolites or postbiotics or compounds. One that you guys would all be aware of and your listeners would be butyrate. So butyrate is a short-chain fatty acid, but there are multiple other metabolites which your microbiome produces. So those two ways are the main ways that myself as a clinician would view the microbiome. What are the species there? And then what are they producing? How are they impacting not just gut health, but overall systemic health?
I think a few points there. I guess for our listeners, it's so funny hearing practitioners talk about the digestive system, because a word that people might say in quiet, we're just like, poo. Yes. No hesitation. Yeah. It is what it is. Correct me if I'm wrong, up to 50% of your poo is bacteria.
It's a very large percentage of that. And that is why even when you start fasting, you'll still poop, because that's going to be your bacteria reproducing.
Mm. It's so fascinating. And I'm really interested as well. How did you find out how many species? And imagine being like a waitress or a waiter, serving you and the other practitioners when you're all talking about your how many strains of bacteria you've got in your gut. How do you measure this?
So you can measure your gut microbiome. So now, this is, we're talking poo, so I hope I don't offend anyone. But poo in my household, it's whenever my dogs do a poo, I always go over and examine. And my wife will hate me saying this, but, I always check in with my wife. Have you done your poo today? It is such an important component of health. And it's something, because I've been in this for years, I've kind of forgotten that sometimes people, maybe when they first start dating, they don't tell each other poo. But it's just become second nature. My family are just like, oh, Brad, we're at a restaurant. You can't talk about poo here.
Well, it's just as important as what we eat,
Exactly. So we can actually measure all of these species and the function within the gut. Now, something that's super, super interesting here is I alluded to before that there could be these 200 odd species in your gut, but they're, and of all of the potential species that we could sequence, right, including species that are found on fruits and vegetables out in the environment within your animal's microbiome, there's upwards of 28,000 different species that you can actually identify, which aren't normally, let's say, found within the human microbiome. I'll give you an example. I had a patient who had this really unusual species. And, I do a bit of searching, and it's because they work on a farm and that the fruit that they harvest is generally higher in that particular species. So we can actually find it within their stool. So what does the process involve? Basically, you wake up very early, maybe on a Monday or a Tuesday morning, and you have all this information laid out, a couple of containers, and you put like a little hammock in the toilet, and you poop into the hammock or a ice cream container, and then you put on some gloves and you play around in your own fecal matter, where you'll scoop out samples and you'll dab this in here and dab that in there. I've done it a number of times. It's a fun process once you get over the smell.
Knowing the results that you're going to get from what comes from that too.
Exactly. Take it from me, from someone who's been in the lab of where you analyze microbiomes, your own poop smells a lot better than other people's poop. You go in there and it is very, very strong.
Oh, I've never thought about that before.
I've never thought about it either.
We digressed. So once you've done this, you will then put it into the post and you do an express post and you send it off to the lab. Now, generally, the lab will get it within 48 hours. And that's really important because we don't want it sitting in the post for too long, because what happens when it's at room temperature, you have microbes grow and you'll get false results when it comes around to actually looking at who's there in your microbiome. Now, it arrives at the lab, and the lab has got all of these U-Bute machines to process different things from functional markers like zonulin or particular species. And just to put it out there, I know that microbiome testing comes with a cost, but there's one particular machine, as soon as you turn it on, it costs over $30,000 to run it. So it's a very expensive process. And so that's why you have, you know, upwards of 100 samples in one go. Mm. So then that $30,000 isn't so much of a large passing on to our patients, because yes, in the early days when we would measure the whole microbiome, it would cost hundreds or thousands of dollars. But now we've managed to bring it down to just a few hundred dollars, which is fantastic. Once it goes through the lab, your practitioner will get a microbiome report, and then they'll utilize that information to go, well, this is what's high, this is what's low. And based on this information, these are the types of treatments that are most appropriate for the patient, or might even provide clues as to why the patient is presenting how they do.
Yeah, we use microbiome testing quite a bit. I'm interested to pick your brain a bit more about what type of testing you use, but we find it quite useful. We see a lot of hormonal conditions and a lot of problems with estrogen, so testing the gut is really important there. But we also see a lot of menopausal women, and it's hard to shift weight. And I've personally found microbiome testing really useful in that phase of life, contributing to weight, but obviously contributing to gut symptoms.
Energy as well.
Energy, yeah, I was going to say people with anxiety, people with depression, people with just like high constant stress. It's interesting when people reach out to us and they're like, hey, do you do anything with the gut? I'm like, it's all the gut, honey. It's where we start.
Yeah.
But so what should we look for when choosing a microbiome test?
Yeah. Something to note here is there are 15 tests that are available in Australia. Now, when you go outside of Australia, there are hundreds. When you go into the UK and America, there are a lot of tests. In Australia, there's about 15 different tests. Now, even quite advanced practitioners can get quite overwhelmed with, well, which test do I choose? What is the difference? At the end of the day, as a patient, trusting your practitioner is the number one place to start. But maybe I can provide a bit more information here. What we want is an accurate and comprehensive test. We want it to be providing us with accurate information and a lot of it. I give the example of iron. Now, when we're measuring iron, we don't just look at ferritin. We look at an array. We look at an iron study where we look at multiple different markers. We also evaluate their menstrual cycle. Are they bleeding too much? We evaluate their diet, their digestive capacity to understand iron absorption. Another example is cholesterol. We're not just looking at total cholesterol. We want to know the breakdown of LDL cholesterol and HDL cholesterol. Where I'm going with this is we have, and if you're watching this, you have a microbiome test on one side, and then on the other side, you've got a microbiome test from the GP. Now, the microbiome test from the GP, fantastic. If you've got acute diarrhea, go to the GP, get what's called a qPCR test done through the GP, and that's going to tell you whether or not you've got a particular bacterial strain that's causing diarrhea. We'll take some antibiotics or antimicrobials, protect the gut, fantastic. But it's not going to give you the type of information that we as practitioners are actually looking for. We look at it and go, great, there's no reason or causative factors for anything else that's going on. So we need a more comprehensive test. Now, I want to keep this above, you know, too depth. So I'm just going to broadly say that there are different ways to measure the microbiome. So there isn't just one set method of measuring the microbiome. There's multiple different methods. An example of this is what we refer to as culture, and that is where we grow the bacteria. What we know here is when we try and grow bacteria, it's only going to show us about 5% of your microbiome. So we don't really want to be utilizing a test that is trying to grow the bacteria because that's not going to be accurate. The next one is PCR. Now, a lot of people might be listening and go, I've heard of this term PCR before. And that is because of COVID. So when you did a COVID test, that was a PCR test. That is looking for whether or not you're positive or negative for a particular microbe, whether it's a virus, whether it's a bacterial. The problem with using PCR is we're only going to be looking at a handful of species, right? So if you don't have what's called a probe looking for a particular species, you're not going to identify it. The last one and the most advanced way to look at the microbiome is something called metagenomics. Basically, this is looking at the DNA of the bacteria. If we look at the DNA of the bacteria, we can understand who is there, what they're doing, what is their function, and we can understand the whole microbiome. So, you know, just double check, you know, the microbiome test that you're using, check for the word metagenomics, and if it's using metagenomics, fantastic. Now, within a microbiome test, there's a few other things that we're looking for. We want to understand diversity and species, the function of the gut, and also the environment. So I'll give you a few examples here. The first one is going to be microbial species. Now, I hope I don't burst anyone's bubble here, Chloe and Georgia, but there is more than just Bifidobacterium and Lactobacillus within the gut. There are so many other beneficial species within the gut. A lot of consumers, when they see a microbiome report and they go, there's no Bifidobacterium, there's no Lactobacillus, half of my job is to say, it's okay. Myself, remember, as we mentioned earlier, I've got the golden poo. I have no Lactobacillus in my gut and I am perfectly healthy. I've got no health conditions. My microbiome is smack on, but I don't have any Lactobacillus because it doesn't matter who's there, but it more matters what they're doing within the microbiome, right? So looking at microbial species, we can look at hundreds and hundreds of different species. The next one, when you're looking for the right microbiome test, is looking for diversity. So diversity is what's going to tell you two things, something called a Shannon index, which is basically a scientific way to gauge what is the balance of your microbiome. And then also it will tell you your richness, and that is the number of species. And that is what you can, you know, compare with your husband, compare with your children, your girlfriends over a coffee. How many species do you have? It's a great conversation starter.
Would love to go to coffee with you, Brad.
So we've got,
you got to get a gut test
and then come along. We get coffee and we'll talk about the different species.
Yeah.
The other thing we're looking for, and there's a few others that we're trying to get from a microbiome test. One of them is going to be functional markers. So they're going to be things like your calprotectin and zonulin, pancreatic elastase, secretory IgA. I know for a lot of listeners, they're like, well, what are these? But for practitioners, these are very accurate biomarkers that can gauge leaky gut, inflammation, whether or not there's any infection, how your digestive system is functioning. So really important to have those and others as well. But then remember what I said earlier about our microbiome can impact our health through species, but also through function. So you want a microbiome report that will report on microbial metabolites. So what is the microbiome's capacity to produce butyrate? Okay, what about hexa-LPS? And of course, beta-glucuronidase, because the species produce this. Now, here's a little caveat, and this is very novel. You know, it hasn't gone into clinical practice just yet, but measuring beta-glucuronidase as the enzyme can provide false information, right? Okay. I know that when I read this, I was like, oh, hold on. Yeah. Have I been using beta-glucuronidase as an enzyme incorrectly for many, many years? Because it's an enzyme, it's greatly governed on transit time, constipation, diarrhea. So if someone's got constipation and it comes back as high, that's not necessarily saying that it is high. It's saying that it's high found within the fecal matter. We don't know whether or not there's sufficient bacteria, producing it, or if there's too many bacteria producing it. So that's why I really like to look at what are the species in the gut that can produce beta-glucuronidase.
It's almost like the more you know with the gut, the less you know. It's such a solar system. Mm. It's like a universe in terms of there's so much more things that we need to know about the gut. And I think what a point that you made earlier, where you specified gut microbiome, because we have microbiomes all over our body, everywhere. Mm-hmm. But what we're talking about is the complexity of what's happening inside the gut.
Yeah. And even for me, I spend day in, day out reading research papers, educating practitioners on the microbiome. I'm learning every single day. And I'm just constantly collating all of that information to better understand health and disease and how to interpret a microbiome report.
Because there was a while there where the approach to gut health was really kill, 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 and then replenish. And then, we know that those things are changing in terms of like common pathogens like blasto and diatomeba, depending on if they're there, do we always want to have that kill approach? I'd love to hear how your tact has changed across the years.
So initially in early days, I'm talking maybe 5+ years ago, maybe 7 years ago, I would utilize a lot of antimicrobials in my practice, but I actually came across some research that was published in 2020 and 2021 that for the very first time, and this is the first time it's done using metagenomic sequencing and humans, where they gave them antimicrobials and measured their microbiome. What the study actually found was prescribing antimicrobials actually reduced the amount of butyrate-producing species, increased the LPS-producing species, and actually caused a more dysbiotic gut. Now, before we throw antimicrobial herbs out the window, they are essential. I'm a herbalist. I love my antimicrobials. Where I'm going with this is we can't just, and most practitioners don't do this, but sometimes consumers, they will read, oh, berberine's good for this, or oregano oil's good for this, and then they will self-medicate at a very high dose long term. But we as practitioners will understand that these antimicrobials are very potent, and so maybe pulse dosing might be needed. And the other thing to consider is, what can we do to support the microbiome rather than just killing, taking different types of prebiotic fibers or things like HMOs to support and protect the microbiome.
What's HMO?
Human milk oligosaccharides. It's a type of prebiotic fiber, which only recently has become available for practitioners. And basically, it's a very gentle way to feed up the microbiome. And so it's that compound found within breast milk, but we can now give it to adults. So we think of it like when you're breastfeeding, you're feeding a very new microbiome. If somebody has a very compromised microbiome, one of the first protocols that I will utilize is I'll prescribe HMOs, so these human milk oligosaccharides, to the patient to actually help to feed up the microbiome.
Breast milk for the win. There's a couple of things I wanted to say there. One was berberine was a really good example, I think, because we see a lot of people come in who...
It's trending.
Yeah. So I've heard that berberine's great for weight loss because it can get on top of insulin resistance.
And acne.
Yes. We see a lot of self-prescription of berberine-containing herbs in particular, which I totally agree. My first question is, what's now going on with the gut microbiome? Because you've been taking it for months on end and nothing's shifted with your weight. Or it being an alternative to metformin. So, yeah, a lot of self-prescription we see there. The second thing I wanted to say was in relation to HMO and the gut microbiome and just different microbiomes, I enjoy reading research on breast milk microbiome because I just find it so fascinating. But we also do a lot of work with the vaginal microbiome now, which is exciting. We see a lot of people undergoing IVF, have experienced pregnancy loss, and the research that's coming out looking at the vaginal microbiome and its effect on implantation and success of pregnancy or even time to pregnancy is fascinating.
Mm.
Is the vaginal microbiome something that you test or have anything to comment on?
There are some amazing practitioners out there doing the vaginal microbiome. It's an interesting one. I don't have a vagina, so it is quite a...
Thanks for confirming.
an interesting topic. If somebody does have quite severe vaginal dysbiosis, there are key practitioners in this profession that I will actually cross-refer.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that they specialize, is that Myra Bradfield?
Yeah.
Yes. She's an absolute guru, PhD on it. Fantastic. Speak to that. But there's other things like sometimes you can gauge a little bit on someone's microbiome to their vaginal microbiome. So if there's high amounts of E. coli that can translocate over to the vagina. And sometimes what can happen is there's really, really high lactobacillus. Now, as I alluded to, lactobacillus, that actually doesn't take up a huge part of the gut microbiome. But what can actually happen is when you're taking the sample, there can be cross-contamination and you'll have results that show high amounts of lactobacillus, but that's actually from the vagina. And you'll be able to see that it's vagina-related species, and that's causing incorrect results on a stool microbiome test.
What's fascinating is that the gut is constantly evolving, as you mentioned. And as we were speaking about before we pressed record, and I hope your wife doesn't mind me mentioning that you both have had multiple microbiome testing, and you could see that being in that relationship, you've had that, is cross-contamination the right word, or translocation of similar bacteria?
So for our listeners, we were discussing off air that in the early stages of my wife's and I dating, I measured her microbiome. That was a great bonding experience. I'm pretty sure it was about 3 months into dating. And then I measured it just recently. We've been together 5 odd years now, and I've got a very stable microbiome, and I can actually see that our top 10 species are very similar between each other, and there is that cross contamination or that cross.
There's
clearly a communication for sure.
Yeah. And so, my point with that, I guess, sorry, is that when I was reading or maybe even listening to a podcast, they gave us a statistic about by the time a child reaches the ages of 12 months or even 2 years, the average antibiotic courses that they would have had is like several at least.
Yeah, it's wow. Huge. Antibiotics in those first 2 years of life, that is a big one, and that can really impact the microbiome. There's particular things that we know is somebody who's got a very stable microbiome, a very healthy microbiome, they've got resilience. So they can take antibiotics, and within 4 to 8 weeks, their microbiome will go back to exactly how it was. Naming any names. Fun fact, I've never taken any antibiotics in my life.
Really?
I've really want to be part of a stool donation program for FMT, so fecal microbiome transplants.
Yeah.
But because I'm based in the Sunshine Coast and they're all in like Sydney and Melbourne, I keep signing up for these programs, but it's quite difficult for me to get my fecal matter down there in a timely manner. Because if you are listening and you've got really healthy microbiome, it's something to consider, because you get paid about $50 per donation, which is $250 a week on average, which is $13,000 a year just for sending off your poop. So then it can be embedded into somebody else.
I should tell my husband to pay off my hex.
Yeah, honestly, forget about influencing. This is it. Yeah. I don't know. We need poop for
influencing.
I am. I at one point I wanted to start a company called Uber Poops, where I'd go around on my bicycle and I'd pick up people's poops and I'd take it to the lab. They were back in the early uni days where I needed a bit more finance.
People, our listeners are like, what's going on?
Yeah, I know. They have to listen from the start. I wanted to know, Brad, in your clinical practice, what are some hormonal conditions that you would measure the microbiome?
Yeah, there's a few. So we've got PCOS, thyroid conditions such as Hashimoto's, Graves', an underactive thyroid, when there's a heavy cycle, endometriosis, acne, menopause. And there's a number of reasons why, because I want to give you the example of PCOS and why measuring the microbiome in someone who has PCOS can provide me as a clinician with, and you guys as clinicians, with more information. What we know from the research is patients or individuals with PCOS will have a reduced microbial diversity. So that's the number of species. Now, this is important because we know that a lower diversity is linked with chronic disease, right? So we want to increase that diversity. That's one thing. The other one here is there's particular species such as E. coli, Shigella, Bacteroides vulgatus, particular species that are more elevated in individuals with PCOS. From a practitioner's perspective, we want to know whether or not that particular patient with PCOS has these elevated species, because that can impact not just their hormones, but also their gut health. Now, there's one that's quite interesting, is this concept of LPS. Now, LPS stands for lipopolysaccharides. Basically, it's a compound on the outside of bacteria, on some bacteria. What the research has shown is individuals with PCOS will have higher amounts of this in their microbiome. Now, not everybody with PCOS, but women with PCOS will have that greater risk of these particular species and this microbial metabolite being higher. The reason why this is important to measure is because high levels of LPS is linked with systemic inflammation.
Because we typically hear about it in endo, or endo and LPS usually get sort of like the main, but yeah, PCOS is
PCOS as well.
Yeah.
And we know that some of these driving factors for changing hormonal pathways is systemic inflammation. So if their microbiome is contributing to systemic inflammation, you can take all the fish oil and curcumin you like, but your microbiome will continuously produce this compound that will contribute to systemic inflammation impacting hormones. Whereby if we actually address this at the root cause, changing the microbiome, then inflammation won't be produced. The other one, and this is a big one, is going to be beta-glucuronidase. What we see in individuals with PCOS is they've got higher activity of beta-glucuronidase, the enzyme responsible for the reactivation of estrogen. So with individuals who are struggling with estrogen detoxification, or estrogen is a driving factor for their acne or their endo or their hormonal conditions, if there's high amounts of this beta-glucuronidase, this enzyme within the gut, after you do your detoxification program, you bring it under the blood and it goes into the gut. If this enzyme is here, it's just going to release it and you're just going to reabsorb it, and that is going to become active again. And then you've got to go through this whole process again. So there's different phases in detoxification. We've got to address the gut first before we start doing this estrogen clearance, because if there's high levels of beta-glucuronidase, then it's not going to work.
And I think it's important to mention too that that's also relevant for males, because especially if they're heavy alcohol drinkers, or if they are sort of getting those estrogenic symptoms or
carry weight around,
That's going to be just as important.
And the last one that I'll mention in relation to a marker that I'd assess would be zonulin. So we see that zonulin is elevated in PCOS patients. So for those of you who don't know, zonulin, was my PhD, is a protein that causes the disassembling of tight junctions, aka leaky gut. Now, in saying that, not every PCOS patient will have low diversity and pathobionts or pathogens or LPS or high beta-glucuronidase or high zonulin, but they could. And it's our duty of care for the patient to evaluate that. And great, if they've just got beta-glucuronidase that's high, we'll address that. And everything else is good, fantastic. But we've got to measure that, because I believe all disease begins in the gut.
Yeah,
I agree. And particularly with conditions like PCOS, if it's driven by insulin and your insulin remains high, you have insulin resistance, not only does that affect the PCOS symptoms like irregular cycles, acne, difficulty shifting weight, puts you at risk of type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease. And if all of this can come back to the gut and modulating the gut so that we can have a nice, healthy microbiome, then gosh, that takes, you know, it contributes to the rest of your life.
And I think people sometimes feel as though they have to spend either, you know, a lot of money on fixing their gut. But I'd love to know from you if you were able to give your top three tips about how somebody could support their microbiome, be it, you know, nutritional, lifestyle, or even supplemental. I'd love to hear that from you.
Yeah. Some general tips for improving the microbiome, the first of which would be fermented foods. I love fermented foods. So adding in fermented foods into your diet every single day, that's going to support with diversity. So all those different species of bacteria in your gut. So examples are...
Yeah, I was going to say examples.
Examples
of that, yeah.
Are your sauerkraut, your kimchi, your kefir, even some homemade kombucha. A lot of the kombucha, which is on the shelf, yeah, it's a better swap than Coke, but it's not going to be the best option for your microbiome. So yes, fermented foods. The other one would be a diverse diet. And so I'm sure everyone has been hearing this concept of consuming more than 30 different plants each and every week. This stems from a research paper that looked at what forms a healthy microbiome. And what they found was individuals who consumed 30 or more different plants and nuts and seeds and vegetables each week had a more diverse microbiome and a healthier microbiome.
Dr. Megan Rossi pushes that a lot on her Instagram. Yeah.
I'm not saying a vegan diet, because even a vegan diet may lack this diversity in plants. I'm talking about a plant-rich diet where there's lots and lots of different plants on your plate. Another example that I would give would be a particular type of prebiotic fiber, which would be glucomannan. Now, glucomannan is amazing for bringing down beta-glucuronidase. So it doesn't just reduce the enzyme, it reduces the bacteria known to produce this enzyme. So glucomannan is a type of fiber and it's found in konjac products. So you would find them in the health food sections. It looks like rice noodles, but it's quite chewy.
Mm.
Now, I've tried, you know, the lasagna konjac products, the noodles. I really like the konjac rice. So the konjac rice, basically, it's an indigestible fiber. It's like a rice substitute. So I'll use it instead of rice. Fantastic if there's insulin resistance.
Mm.
But you can also get glucomannan, that's that type of prebiotic fiber, in a supplement. I sometimes use that.
Mm, fascinating. Such good tips. The only thing I wanted to say about fermented foods is that we see a lot of endometriosis in clinic, and we've had, and you know, every single individual you see is completely different and you take it case by case, but we see a lot of histamine intolerance with endometriosis. And so part of the work that we do sometimes is to work through food to lower foods that are high in histamine to help manage some of the big endo symptoms, whether it's the endo belly, whether it's the painful periods, temporarily, obviously, because a low histamine diet can be quite restrictive. And one of the big groups that it cuts out is anything fermented. So this is where it can get really interesting. And again, probably why it's so important to dig deep into the gut microbiome so that we can give treatment recommendations that are completely individualized based on your set of symptoms, but your microbiome.
And it's that personalized care. And that is why working with a practitioner is absolutely essential, because they will be able to take all of these things, your health history, into consideration, and then prescribe what is the best treatment recommendation for you. So yes, of course, I can, on a very broad level, say fermented foods, a diverse diet, and glucomannan are great for the gut microbiome from a hormonal perspective, but can you actually tolerate fermented foods?
Mm.
Is glucomannan the right fiber for you based on whether or not you've got constipation or not? So if you've got constipation, you may want to utilize GOS or inulin or other types of prebiotic fibers to bring down the beta-glucuronidase. So that personalized prescription is going to be key.
Brad, I've got one final question for you. Clients come to us and say, oh, I can't do legumes, I can't do beans, it just doesn't agree with me. And as much as we try to say, stick with it, what is your advice to clients who may have that same sort of pushback when you say that you want them to eat more of that type of food?
So I classify this into three categories. We have super sensitive, sensitive, and slightly sensitive on a scale of where a patient sits in their response to eating legumes. If they are super sensitive, then, well, the end goal here is to reintroduce, but we do that by a small amount over a long period of time. So if somebody is super, super sensitive, and I've had patients, you know, a few years ago, super, super sensitive, able to now consume dal and you know, lentils on a salad, what they start off with is a quarter of a teaspoon of well-cooked rinsed lentils. Now, you may say that is a very, very small amount.
Mm.
But over a course of a month, then you increase it to half a teaspoon. And then and you just keep on going. It generally takes between that 12 to 18 months alongside a gut repair protocol. But if you stick with it, you'll be able to consume it. I give a very extreme example of an allergic response. So children who are allergic to eggs, they will work with an immunotherapist where they will be prescribed a very, very small amount of a overly cooked egg over a 12 to 18 month period. And at one point they were anaphylactic to egg and now they are not. And so similar approach with these legumes and beans and lentils, it starts with a very, very small amount and slowly work your way up.
It's almost like in this day and age, people go hard and fast. It's like, oh, I'm vegan, or I'm going to do carnivore, and now I'm only plant-based. And your gut needs that time to, you know, if it's not used to having chickpeas.
Adjust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the example of going to the gym. If you haven't been to the gym in 6 months and you go in there and you're pumping iron, the next day you are going to be sore. You might tear something, you might pull something. But if you go in there slowly, you work your shoulders and then you work your biceps, and then you start doing bench presses and all of that, no problems.
Yeah.
Slowly work your way up.
This has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for your time, Brad. We really, really appreciate you coming on and chatting all about the gut and your resilient poo.
Yes. I want to test my microbiome now and I want to eat Brad's.
You're so competitive.
I am so competitive. I am that person that goes into the gym and I go all or nothing.
He's not going to meet up for you with coffee unless you have more than 150 species.
We can't be friends unless you've got the 200 species.
Oh, yeah, so great. I love that. Well, thank you so much, Brad. This has been great.
And Brad, before we let you go, if people are interested in finding out a little bit more about the gut, where can they find you?
Yep, they can head over to my socials or my website, drbradleach.com.
Yeah, amazing.
Amazing.
Thanks so much.
Well, Georgia, it's been fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode.
If you liked it, leave us a review and follow us on socials. We'd love to hear from you.